Conversation Show. I'm your host, Ashley Easter, and this is my co-host today,
Maureen Garcia.
Yes, Maureen is one of our board members. You have seen her before. She often co-hosts, help me come up with questions, help me find speakers. She has so much wisdom on her own, and we decided to have a conversation about a hot topic that is all over the media right now, and that is Pastor Matt Chandler. We're going to be talking about Matt Chandler and the quote unquote inappropriate text messages he sent to another woman, what our kind of hot takes are, a bit of the history behind Matt Chandler, and just sort of our opinions. And I do want to preface this with, we will be reading quotes from like the Washington Post article, some other articles and things, but these are our opinions. We don't know everything that's happening behind the scenes, but we want to talk about some things that are kind of concerning. So stay tuned for that. You're going to want to watch this one all the way through and go ahead and hit the share button because, guys, people need to be aware of this conversation and not just what's happening now, but the history behind Matt Chandler, because it's kind of shocking. So go ahead and share this on social media so your friends and family can stay in the loop. And we will be back after these messages.
Anxiousness can strike at any time, while driving a car, in the middle of the night, when giving a work presentation, or in a crowded place. Introducing Calmigo, a smart calming device that learns your personal breathing patterns and adapts to you for immediate relief in just 3 minutes. It quiets your senses through breathing regulation, multi-sensory stimulation, and calming scents. Don't stress another moment. Click the Learn More button and start using Calmigo today.
Hey guys, I'm back with Maureen Garcia, and we're going to be talking about Matt Chandler today, the recently disgraced pastor who has stepped down or been forced to step down and is taking a leave of absence, supposed to be temporary, but we'll see how things go. If for some reason you haven't heard about Matt Chandler, there are tons of news articles about him now. But I think it's going to be helpful for this conversation if we sort of do a recap of what's happening, who Matt Chandler is, and then we kind of get into the controversy. And Maureen, you are so good with doing recaps and kind of bringing people up to date. Would you mind doing that for us?
Sure. So Matt Chandler is a pastor in Texas in a church called the Village Church, and it's a very large church. And he was influenced by a number of, I guess they would be like Reformed Calvinist, Neo-Calvinist. So like John Piper. He's also, or was up until a couple of days ago, Matt Chandler was also the president of Acts 29, which is a network of church plant, a network of churches for church planting. And the Acts 29 was originally founded by Mark Driscoll and somebody else. And Mark Driscoll, of course, we know because he had some
major
allegations. Yes, major scandals and allegations about him having a toxic culture in his church. And, you know, and then he was missing for a while and then got replatformed. And we've talked about replatforming before. But anyway, at some point in, I think 2012, Matt Chandler took over as president of Acts 29 Network. And he's a popular preacher. His sermons are popular. He writes a bunch of books. His wife has written some books. They've done like marriage seminar kind of things together. They have 3 children. I think they've been married like 18 years. And so that's the gist on Matt Chandler. So do you want me to go into a little history of some of the stuff that's popped up in the Village Church history?
Yeah, you know, I think that might be good to do. And just sort of like for people who are coming in completely cold to this, the Village Church is a mega church. And my understanding is it has satellite locations. And we're not talking about some little podunk church out in the woods. Like, this is a big deal business. kind of church, right. and mm-hmm. massive PR arm and books and all the things. So yeah, I think that's right. important to know, because whether you're familiar with him or not, he is, and his church is, shaping a lot of the evangelical culture recently, particularly yeah. with the hard lean into Neo-Calvinism that we've yeah. seen, I think, really have an uptick since, what would you say, maybe like 2012, 2014, something like that?
I would actually say that it started a bit before that. The early the early 2000s, there was starting to be more books that were being written, and you know, but not necessarily explicitly identifying as Neo-Calvinist kind of theology.
Right.
And that, but then it became much more mainstream to refer to it that way and to self-identify as Reformed or Calvinist.
Got it.
But it's very influential, and Matt Chandler is very influential, and so is his church, and Acts 29. They're influential in pretty much everything, but their theology, while it's Neo-Calvinist, so many parts of that have become mainstream in non-Calvinist evangelical churches because of the popularity of preachers like Matt Chandler and formerly, you know, Mark Driscoll. So the first time I had heard about Matt Chandler in the Village Church was, I want to see what year, hold on, give me 1 second just to check a year here. But basically, can't find it. I think it might have been 2015, somewhere around there. But what happened was a fellow in the Village Church, in Matt Chandler's church, had confessed, I think him and his wife were missionaries, but he had confessed to viewing child sexual abuse images or videos or whatever, what's, you know, often called child porn. So he had confessed to viewing some of that, and he, you know, talked to the elders about it, and his wife was very concerned, and I believe that they were, wherever they were based, so they were recalled from doing their missionary service, and they were in South Asia at the time. So they come back to Texas, and let's see here. So the church did exactly what they were supposed to do, which is great. They turned over the information to the police, and then there was an investigation. Let's see. And what is the fellow's name? Jordan. I think it's Jordan Root. Anyway, so what the church did was they put him under some kind of disciplinary action to try to, I guess, further his spiritual maturity. Right. Yes. Like, yeah. So some consequences for certain behaviors, but he had to like agree to, walk the walk that they had said, this is your discipline for this behavior. And this is, what we believe is best for you, for your family, for everybody else. Right.
And so far that sounds like, maybe not perfect, but pretty good for a church. Yeah.
Yes. It's actually really good. They removed him from having access to any youth or children. And, they did the things that they, or at least they did most of the things, the first steps. But then what happened was his wife, Karen, I'll remember the name in a minute, but his wife, Karen, wanted to have an annulment.
Hinckley, I believe.
Yes, right. Karen Hinckley, right. So she wanted to have an annulment, and she didn't want to be married to this man anymore because of, this viewing child sexual abuse stuff. And you can understand her concern.
Yeah.
This is a big, this is and a weighty kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Something to also keep in mind about annulments. I've seen some Christians, and I don't know what her beliefs were, but some Christians who maybe feel that divorce is wrong will be okay with annulment, because annulment is often based on, I was fraudulently married, and so this wasn't actually bound by a contract where both people had like the enthusiastic consent because it was fraudulent. So it's actually kind of a powerful loophole, particularly for people who feel that divorce maybe goes against what their personal beliefs are. And it's really understandable, whether it's a divorce or an annulment, not wanting to be associated with a guy who behaves that way towards children.
Right. Or, yes, because the behavior would be the viewing.
Viewing, yes.
Because whether or not people, it's not a victimless crime. The children in the videos are being abused, and he is, you know, watching that, which means that to some degree he's participating in that. So it's not just like, you know, this was harmful behavior. So you're right when you say, you know, this kind of behavior. Even if he never inappropriately touched a child in real life or did some kind of non-contact sexual abuse of a child in real life, the fact that he was viewing those images is problematic enough, and it is being a part of that whole
It's part of the system of abusing children.
Yes, absolutely. Right. So, you know, his wife obviously doesn't want to be, you know, married to this man anymore, be sexual with this man anymore. And you're right. So annulments are great in that it lets you, again, if in a lot of churches, a lot of theology says that once you're married permanently, you know. And I'm not sure what Matt Chandler's personal beliefs are, but I do know that he's written somewhere about him and his wife, and that for the two of them going into marriage, they both knew that divorce was never going to be an option.
Right.
And I think in general, that would be the majority view within Calvinistic evangelical circles. The majority view is you shouldn't divorce.
Right.
You know, for any reason, except for something that's biblically mandated, like adultery, but even that's frowned upon.
Yeah. Right.
So, so Karen wants to get an annulment, and basically the church leaders tell her that, here we go, I have a quote from Chandler here. We have, this is Matt Chandler from around 2015-ish. We've reached out to love and support her during this time, but unfortunately she's chosen not to accept our attempts to care for her and provide counsel. Instead, Karen limited her communication with the village and has now stopped responding entirely. This began less than 4 weeks after Karen's return to the U.S., when she filed for an immediate annulment of her marriage to Jordan, apart from the counsel of the church, and requested to be placed back in the mission field. We encouraged Karen to slow down and allow us to walk with her in a season of healing before making these life-altering decisions, but she declined to take this step. And then he adds, Karen's decision to pursue immediate annulment, to decline an attempt of reconciliation, to disregard her membership covenant and pastoral counsel, and to break fellowship with the body has led her into formal church discipline. So you have a man who's admitted to looking at child abuse, sexual abuse images or videos, and you know he has some, you know, covenant that they created for him to get better and heal and grow. But then they also expect his wife, who's done nothing wrong, to submit to their counsel, their leadership, their wisdom,
and to lose her job.
Yes, and to lose her job and. The language is, you know, the language is great. We've reached out to love and support her, but she has, you know, she's refused our love and support, right? But the problem is they're reaching out to love and support her with certain conditions.
Yeah.
And one of the conditions is you can't, that you need to be on a path of reconciling with your husband who, you know, has some issue with child sexual abuse images. So, you know, it's one thing to love and support someone who's going through this. And I think that they had actually intended also to help support her, financially during, the initial separation, as long as the goal is reconciliation with the husband.
Yeah.
That's a big problem that instead of supporting somebody, you know, you know,
she did nothing wrong. She reported it, went through the chain of command.
Yes.
He understandably and rightfully lost his job and position, was reported to the police. Whether I think it's effective, the route the church wanted to go with church discipline is besides the point, but it was, I would think, called for your organization to have some disciplinary action, you know, in addition to law enforcement. But for her,
right,
who did nothing wrong and only did the right thing by reporting to, one, be pulled out of the mission field, that is her job, and then, two, to be expected to be bound by to this, what I would say is a dangerous man, and then to be disciplined. And from what I recall from the articles that I read, it was somewhat publicly within email chains that were sent out, and to be humiliated when she is not the person doing anything wrong. I mean, when we talk about the Village Church, this is the church that we're talking about. And I read an article that said that in 2015, Chandler and the other church leaders apologized to her for admitting to treating her in an unchristian way. But the damage is already done. This was a softball being pitched to them, and for them to mess it up that badly, I don't think that's just easily fixed with a, oops, sorry about that, we didn't know any better, you know, kind of thing. Like,
Well, it reveals some underlying kind of assumptions. And the one of the underlying assumptions would be, you know, if you're married and your husband does something that requires some kind of church discipline or church, you know, like elder intervention, that you also need to be disciplined or guided, if you want a nicer word.
Subjected to some other.
Mandatory. And then when she, when she chooses to not accept the love and support, you know, there's, like you said, there was this internal chain of emails, and there's all this external pressure on her to resubmit herself under their leadership, and to do what they've asked her to do, including, you know, reconciling with her husband, which, I mean, that, first of all, I mean, at the very least, that is a very unfair expectation to have of somebody in that situation. You know, and at the worst, you're putting her in a position where, how is she supposed to ever do ministry, missionary work with this man? She's going to constantly be worried about his interactions with children on the mission field. You know, she's not going to be able to, it's just a terrible thing to put that weight on her. She's not responsible.
Even aside from like the missions work and the job stuff, but just for her to have to be expected for the rest of her life that she's going to be like his accountability partner. That is not stress that any woman or man should have to be subjected to if that's not something they want to be a part of, you know? Because years ago they married somebody under the pretense that they were actually a good person who wasn't, you know, engaged in these nefarious things.
So Chandler, I'm going to read you a little bit of part of the apology quoted in another email to Karen. So he basically said, in every way that we've mishandled the situation, along with others in the past, we repent and ask for forgiveness. You know, in this moment, we are clinging to the truth, knowing that we and everyone else involved in the situation desperately need the grace and mercy of Jesus. I got no problem with us needing the grace and mercy of Jesus. But to suggest that that Karen needs it to the same degree in the same ways as her husband, you know, at that time period you know, it's kind of like, I don't know. So, but the main part of this apology that bothers me, in every way that we've mishandled the situation, is probably the most vague statement of apology ever. In every way we've mishandled the situation, there's nothing specific. And then he adds, along with others in the past, we repent and ask for forgiveness. Well, what situations are you talking about in the past? Now you've added more vagueness on top of the initial vagueness. And what we're going to see as we talk a little bit more is that part of, like, me and Ashley and everybody out there, you know, we don't know what transpired between Matt and this woman that, you know, it's his friend that he was direct messaging, right? We can't know that. But, I mean, we eventually can if the elders decide to release the report that the independent investigation, but we really can't know that. And so give me a second. I just lost my train of thought. So since we can't know that, we can't say that, you know, we don't know if this is a situation of clergy abuse. You know, was she a congregant under his spiritual leadership? And then did he use that to try to groom her to begin some kind of emotional or sexual affair? We don't know if that kind of thing happened. It's happened in other places. But from what it seems like, from what Matt has said, and from what others have reported, it doesn't seem like that's necessarily the case. So we can't say that he's done anything abusively. And even when we go back over situations where there were kind of scandals in the church history and how he responded, it doesn't look like he's done anything egregiously horrific, but he does do things where he doesn't seem to see or understand the weight of what's going on. So like, for instance, with Karen, he didn't seem to understand the weight of the situation, asking someone to remain married to someone who has you know, child sexual abuse compulsion, like to watch that stuff. And it's, I mean, it's not for someone like me and for someone like Ashley, it's not that shocking that he would not notice certain things or overlook certain things or minimize certain things, because he's in a culture where that's the norm. So like, for instance, by now, everybody knows that a number of years ago, John Piper made, he answered a question about how does a wife submit to an abusive husband? And he infamously now has said, it was something along the lines of, as long as it's just emotional abuse and, you know, she can endure being slapped or hit for one, right, as long as it's not physically hurting her, which is a statement of a vast ignorance about how abuse works and abuse dynamics in general. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if all of Matt's heroes have no real good grasp on abuse and what it is and what it looks like, it's not surprising that he would also miss certain things that are dangerous or problematic, right, or, yeah, you know.
And I think part of this conversation, part of this conversation, like you said, is not coming from a place, and we will get into it in a little bit, about some of the quotes around Chandler stepping down and, you know, what they said about it. We'll get to that in a minute. It's not so much that we know what happened, but it's important to understand the history and to track patterns. And at some point, maybe in the past, I don't think it's a good argument, but I think maybe an argument might have been made that he just didn't know any better. But up to this point, he's had years and years to learn to do better. And so we're kind of bringing up some of these past things, not to say that we at the end know exactly what happened, because we don't yet.
Right.
But to say some pretty ugly stuff has happened in the past to make us suspicious. And it's important to pick up on some of these patterns. So I think talking about this Karen Hinckley situation, where she was treated just atrociously by the church, is one of them. But then we have an even more recent situation. So people could be like, Oh, well, that was kind of before the Me Too era, you know, they have more opportunity to learn. But just recently, there has been a lawsuit settled. And I'm going to read this. It's a quote from a Washington Post article. And it says, Village Church announced that it has settled a lawsuit alleging that one of its ministers molested 11-year-old, and the church was negligent in handling the situation. The criminal case against the minister was dismissed. The church maintained that it committed no wrong. So very recently, there's been a case that, if I'm not mistaken, there's been a criminal case and a civil case. And the criminal case was dismissed. And keep in mind, criminal cases get dismissed all the time for lack of evidence. Lack of evidence doesn't mean something didn't happen, but it can be difficult to try something such as molestation, because unless there was a video camera there, it's very hard to just show and document what happened. So it's not uncommon for a criminal case around sexual abuse not to move forward. not because it's not legitimate, but because it's so hard to provide proof.
Prosecutors will dismiss something if there isn't enough evidence where they think that they'll have a chance of winning.
Right.
But like you said, an unfounded allegation or a dismissed allegation is not the same as a false allegation.
Exactly.
So it happens where there's just not enough evidence. So the criminal case was dismissed and the civil case. Go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The civil case was moving forward. Criminal case means somebody might go to jail or have fines by the government, the city, wherever you live, where it's being tried. Civil case usually has to do with money. Mm-hmm. It's not really having to do with is somebody going to jail or not. Maybe things like emotional distress, or sometimes the statute of limitations is different for civil cases versus criminal cases. So anyway, there's a civil case that moves forward after a while. That case is not dismissed, but is settled. And I have seen a statement put out by the church, and it's kind of in a synopsis in this quote from the Washington Post, but basically the church is saying, we've done no wrong. They're pointing to the dismissed criminal case and pretty much saying, like, implying, I would say, in my opinion, that since it was settled, that's not proof that we didn't do anything wrong. That's not the case with civil cases. You can settle for a lot of reasons. And to my understanding, the articles I've read, the people I've spoken to, I'm not seeing an indication that there was something that showed that the victim wasn't speaking truthfully about the situation. I don't get that impression anywhere. Right. A lot of times people settle cases. You got to remember, this is against an 11-year-old girl. Would you want to spend your teen years and early adult years tied up in civil litigation when you're trying to go to college, when you're trying to figure out your path in life, when you're trying to think about dating, when you're trying to think about would a child, a teen, a young adult want to continue in something like that? Also, we haven't seen who paid who. And so that's kind of an interesting thing. At least I haven't seen that. But you have these strong allegations that came against the church, and I haven't seen a particularly good, in my opinion, rebuttal against them. It's more just like, well, the case was settled, so let's brush it under the rug. So it's not determined by a court how that case went, but knowing kind of how they've handled things poorly with the Karen Hinckley case. I have a lot of questions about that. Do you have any comment on that particular case as we're kind of putting into place some of the history of the Village Church and Matt Chandler?
Yeah, so the civil suit was recently wrapped up, and they have an update on their Village Church website from August 1st of this year. Letting everybody know that civil lawsuit has been settled. And they also let everybody know that the criminal charges had been dismissed. Let's see what else. They do talk a bit on their website about, like, you know, having a high priority for safety for children in their care, which is good. But that also, I mean, one of the things Matt Chandler has done in response to this is basically, like you just said recently, actually, that he doesn't think that they've done anything wrong, that they did all the things they were supposed to do, that they reported to the police, and that they cooperated with the police in the investigation, and didn't release any information, which this is very common if the police or the FBI or some kind of task force is investigating certain types of crimes, they will ask church members or church leaders to not inform the community yet until we have such and such information, kind of a thing. But he basically says that, you know, he let himself be led by the family of the victim and by the police detective and what he was going to do and reveal and whatever. And you know, there are so many churches that don't report, that don't get the police involved, that don't cooperate with an investigation. So that's all great. The problem is that that is the minimum of what, you know, as a Christian community,
yeah,
they're responsible for doing. I mean, there should be support for the victim and their loved ones. And, you know, broader than that, support for the other victims in the community when they find out that this has been going on. And then, you know, at its broadest point, support for your whole congregation, because a lot of them will be reeling from finding out that someone who's a trusted youth minister, you know, may or may not have abused a child that's part of their community. So they, with the Karen Hinckley situation, with this situation, even if they're doing the minimum of what's legally required, there are other things that they need to do to create communities that are safe for, well, for everybody, especially the vulnerable. And yeah, one of the difficulties for me, like, again, on the Village Church website, they have an update about this whole situation. But one of the questions that they have gotten asked is, give me a second. Like, they give some information about how to talk to your children about sexual abuse, some books and resources to use, but there is a question on the website that says, do I need to keep an extra eye on my children at church because the alleged perpetrator is at our church? And they say no. The clear and emphatic answer to this question is no. We would not allow anyone who is under investigation for a crime like this to be near children at the Village Church. Now, yes, the way that question is worded, the answer is no. You don't need to keep an extra eye on your children at the church because that alleged perpetrator is at the church. But the reality is that there's so many unknown perpetrators within mm-hmm. churches, and there are other possibly known or unknown perpetrators that have already been convicted and released, or convicted and paroled, or so the just saying no, that's not enough. That's giving a false sense of security. You know, the answer should be yes. We should always, the whole community, keep an extra eye on all the children and anyone vulnerable in these ways. And never, you can't just unilaterally just say no.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't keep an extra eye on your child because of that one perpetrator. Because mm-hmm. the reality is that one perpetrator, especially in a megachurch, statistically, is not the only perpetrator.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is problematic. And of course, the other problem is, you know, when Matt Chandler says that he doesn't think that they behaved in any, you know, he's basically saying they didn't do anything wrong, but it's like, okay, you didn't do anything wrong. You might not have done anything legally wrong, but as a Christian, morally, ethically, someone who is, mm-hmm. is called and proclaimed to live, to follow Jesus, you know, morally, ethically, you have an obligation to do far beyond
yeah.
the minimum of what's legally required of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that would bring us up to his recent apology.
Yeah. Yeah. And so let's kind of get into that. After we kind of get into the current stuff, I want to take one more trip back his relationship with his wife, which is quite interesting. But
yeah.
let's actually transition into talking about the current stuff before we look at that, and then we'll sort of put all the patterns together at the end.
Right.
So I'm quoting from a Washington Post article that came out, and I'm just going to read these things and then we'll have some discussion about it. So basically this article is about Matt Chandler and some inappropriate text messages that came out. So it says, the leaders determined that the messages were not romantic or sexual. Chandler explained, it was that our conversations were unguarded and unwise. Chandler and church officials went into scant detail about the nature of the message, but he said both his wife and the husband of the woman he was messaging knew about their communications, but the church leaders thought messaging was too familiar, frequent, and resulted in coarse and foolish joking. Chandler said. They revealed that Matt did not use language appropriate for a pastor, and he did not model the behavior that we expect from him. That's what the church leaders were saying. The pastor said that the messages were called into question several months ago when a friend of the woman approached him and voiced her concerns. Chandler, 48 years old, said he brought the concerns to fellow church leaders who reviewed the messages and recommended he step aside. And this, after kind of all this happens, goes before the church. There is some very vague language about him stepping away. And he kind of does this apology, not apology thing, which we'll get into. And now he's on a leave of absence, and we're not exactly sure for how long. But when you kind of look at the past things going on here, this strikes me as really strange. And I want to get your take on it in just a second, Maureen. The things that are initially standing out to me is, number one, they were very clear that it was not romantic or sexual.
Right.
And maybe that's true. Maybe that's true. And we'll maybe explore a thought experiment about if that's true. But kind of knowing the evangelical church, knowing the history of the Village Church, there are questions in my mind going on that are like, well, what would they count as romantic or sexual? And would that be the same definition that the general public would have? So that's a question that comes to my mind. Other things when I'm looking at it is, they said that there was coarse and foolish joking. And I'll try to link this. But we have listened to a video where he goes on this rant about church members anonymously sending emails about complaints they have in the church, and him just like going off and using what I would say very coarse language. And this is publicly recorded to an audience, calling sheep with rabies, like his congregation, comparing them to sheep with rabies. He uses, you know, very just short of expletives, and it's just very angry and aggressive. And even at the end of his little rant, he says, this is probably something I should work on. And so
that's, I'm completely unfamiliar with that.
So. Oh, you are? Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to link.
Look at that.
Yeah. I had assumed you'd seen that. I will link to that so people can watch it, and so you can watch it.
I assume he's trying to be satirical. He's trying to be like,
I guess so. He sort of does it in a joking way, but it comes across as very aggressive. So they say it's not sexual or romantic, which I'm like, okay, what's your definition of that? I'd be interested. They say that it is because of coarse and foolish joking, which to me, he's done that before without consequence. They say that the message was too frequent and familiar, but that both his wife and her husband knew about it. And then also contrasting that, there was a separate woman who heard about the text messages, was uncomfortable enough to come to this pastor and say, hey, this makes me uncomfortable that you'd be sending these messages. That held enough weight for him to then talk to fellow church leaders, which then led them to some sort of a formal investigation, which then led them to have him step down, at least for a short amount of time. And then, and we'll link to a really great synopsis of his apology, where one of our other board members, Eric, is kind of going blow by blow with the apology, not apology. He still says he doesn't really know what he did. And so I look at this and I'm like, well, they say it's not sexual. If he's already done coarse and foolish joking before, if both spouses knew about it, why did it make that other woman so uncomfortable that she had to confront him? And why was it such a big deal that they had to, I assume, pay an investigative company to look into it? And then the result was him having a disciplinary action, but he still doesn't really know what he did wrong. What's happening here?
Yeah, those are some good questions. I think from what I read, it was a friend of the woman he was direct mm-hmm. messaging that confronted him.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm glad he took her concern seriously, I guess. But I'm still not sure what those concerns are. You know, so it is interesting. He goes to the elders and he talks to them, and they want to look through all the direct messaging and mm-hmm. the interaction between him and this woman, who I'm assuming was not contacted and asked if they could get her consent before they look through
her responses. I'd be interested to know,
because you know that would probably be the best first step if you're thinking of going in that direction. And then whatever they saw was, like you said, it's not sexual and it's not romantic, but it was concerning enough for them to hire what I've seen referred to as a boutique law firm to do an independent investigation and a report.
And those are expensive, guys. Those are expensive. Yeah. This isn't like you're throwing $500. This is a little bit of money.
So what's the concern? If it's not sexual and romantic, then and also here's the other thing, and I know that this is not going to be the most popular opinion among some Christians, but if she isn't a congregant, she isn't someone under his spiritual leader, and the two of them did have some kind of an emotional affair or physical affair, then that's between him and her and their spouses, you know, and God. You know, but if there is some kind of clergy abuse that's happening, if the coarse language or the joking was, you know, potentially some type of grooming to see if he could push boundaries, to see if he can get her talking about things that are coarse or eventually sexual or romantic, that's one kind of thing, you know, which is a possibility. But it's like, you know, if it's not an abusive situation, or if it's not something that could have legal repercussions for the church, why are they hiring people to investigate and complete a report? And then why are they keeping the information in the report private? So their reason that they've given publicly is, well, they don't want to out this woman and embarrass her and humiliate her, which I think that horse has already left the barn.
Yeah. I mean, agreed, but that's already happened. And now that you've made this a big deal, you might as well redact, you know, information that would.
So you basically just cross out any identifying information, make sure that her name isn't there. You know, so that's not a good enough reason to, if there's nothing in the report, why won't you share the report?
Right.
You know? And you've raised, nobody asked, like mm-hmm. the congregation and public didn't come forward and say, you know, mm-hmm. we need to know what's going on with Matt Chandler and all his, you know, opposite sex friendships. But they've raised this and they've brought it up to a concerning level of behavior that you would do in a situation that is concerning, like potentially harmful to people, and also potentially, you know, the church could be potentially financially liable in some way. So why go to all that trouble? And then when Matt Chandler is giving his apology, again, he's not, you know, it's like his other vague apology. I apologize for all the things that we did wrong this time and all the times in the past. So this time it's like, I apologize for the thing that I'm not sure is wrong, but they're telling me it's wrong. So I'm going to apologize for that. And then, you know, then we're going to deal with whatever unhealthiness I need to learn how to see. And I do agree that there are things he needs to learn how to see. You know, he needs to learn how to see, well, how do you support people who have been betrayed or victimized, or how do you support survivors? How do you support the family and the child, the victim of one of your youth ministers, allegedly?
Yeah.
You know, how do you walk through people in your congregation or community who are in, you know, situations like that? It's a very rough and kind of weighty thing. So he does need to open his eyes to a lot of things, and also to the unfairness of, you know, like with Jordan Root and the whole, okay, you're going to be disciplined this way, and Karen, you're going to join in the discipline, but then when she backs out, all of a sudden there's pressure put on her, and there's this unfairness between what's expected of males and females, and it's the same thing with this here, like Matt gets to go up on stage and, you know, do another one of these public apologies, get people shouting that they love him, get a standing ovation, which, you know, can we stop? Can we stop, Christian community, with the standing ovations? There's enough, you know?
Yeah.
When somebody apologizes to you personally, do you ever applaud for them? Why do we do this? You know, it makes no sense to me.
It really doesn't.
But he has this opportunity and the platform to be able to come forward and tell his version of the story. And, you know, while he is, you know, at one point he says that he's horribly embarrassed and he's ashamed. And I would understand that, totally would understand that. This, you know, but whoever this woman is, who he unfortunately used the euphemism "that other woman" when he was talking about her, which people went wild with, like, okay, if he's referring to as that other woman, does that mean she's some kind of mistress, right? But this other woman doesn't have that opportunity to do that.
Right.
And even if she came forward now and said, you know, Matt didn't do anything wrong, this is a totally normal friendship kind of relationship, you know, people are gonna just judge her harshly.
Yeah.
And it's already embarrassing and humiliating for her. Mm-hmm. Even if she comes forward and says, you know, this is all, everything's fine. And if she comes forward and does accuse him of something, well, we've seen how that goes down. You know, that's never a fun thing. But just, there's this unfairness between the males and the females and what's expected of them.
It's just so fascinating. And I think that's a really good point with the unfairness between men and women. Because all of these cases, whether it is with Karen Hinckley, whether it is with the 12-year-old girl who is molested, whether it is this situation, men are making unilateral decisions for women in these situations, assuming that they are right. And we're not hearing the opinions of what women want or girls want. We're not really privileged to hear their side of the story.
You know, not even,
And so that's an interesting thing. And then, you know, let's have the thought experiment that it is not romantic or sexual, which maybe I'm just so jaded, but I have a hard time believing that. Like, I really do. I can't prove anything. This is my personal opinion, but I would be interested in his definition of romantic and sexual and her definition or pop culture's definition, all those things. But let's imagine that they're telling the truth, that it was not romantic or sexual, that it was simply some joking around and talking to someone who is not your wife a little too much. Well, then in that case, are we just bringing up a situation where unmarried men and women aren't allowed to have friendships? Would the same action have been taken if it was him and another pastor buddy or another man friend from his childhood? So then are we, if there's actually no crimes committed, if there's actually no clergy abuse, if there's actually nothing sexual happening, are we then just demonizing adult friendships between men and women? And if that's the case, that's not good either, because
not at all.
That gets into the whole theology that they hold of complementarianism, where men and women are equal, where women will never be able to have equal positions and influence because they're not allowed to even have friendly text messages with somebody frequently. If there's no abuse involved, like, that also is odd and weird. But that doesn't, that scenario doesn't satisfy me, because I'm thinking, if that was the case and it was just a too friendly friendship with nothing wrong happening really in there, why would you pay an expensive, assumably expensive law firm to investigate this? Why would you bring it in front of the whole church versus just saying, Matt, you know, you can't do that anymore. Your phone's on timeout for the next 3 months. Like, what was the purpose? And he also talks about in the apology how he's held to a higher standard than other people. So there's this distancing of other people might be able to do worse things and it's not bad for them, but I have a shorter leash. And so minimizing what he's done, again, without them saying really what he's
whatever done that is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It leaves right. so many questions. And mm-hmm. I kind of want to go back and look at some of the patterns, because we don't have answers at this point, because mm-hmm. we haven't heard from the woman. She hasn't given a statement as far as I can tell.
And she is under no obligation to do so. She can.
Yeah, absolutely not.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, 100%. Like, she does not need to say anything.
No one is entitled to her speaking or her opinion of this or her experience of this. And I know that tons of people are going to want it. And we live in an age where I'm sure there are tons of people right now that are trying to figure out how can we access those direct messages
so
we
can get
the public. And, you know, we don't. We're not entitled to that stuff. This was, even if he did something wrong, that's mm-hmm. that's not unless she's sharing it or you know mm-hmm. that's just not for us to know.
Her autonomy as a woman.
Yep.
But I guess because we have so many questions, since it is so vague, mm-hmm. since his apology really wasn't an apology, and again we'll link to a video of that, because we have video that we'll link to of him having coarse, foolish joking in a crowd that he wasn't penalized for in the past. I want to go over one other thing, and Maureen, you kind of brought this up, and I want to be able to then tie things together with some patterns. So, you know, we've mm-hmm. got the recent case of the molestation allegations with the 11-year-old girl that has been settled, but I think for a lot of us, it's not settled. Like, there was some strong allegations there, and we don't know, and I don't think we can just sweep that away because there was a settlement of the case. So that's there. We know there's at least been allegations. Mm-hmm. And then before that, we have Chandler Church admitting to how they treated Karen Hinckley with the terrible actions of her husband, and then just how they compounded that trauma towards her. So they've admitted to that. We also have this vague admittance thing here with the text messages, but even going back farther, there's kind of some weird stuff with how Matt and his wife met and situations that seem a bit unethical to me. And do you want to give like a little overview of that?
Sure. So from what I understand from videos that him and his wife have done, and from things that they themselves have written, and from a podcast that his wife Lauren was on a number of years ago after she had published a book, because they've talked a lot about their marriage. But the situation where they met seems to have been that she was at a summer camp. She was 17, and he was preaching at the summer camp, and he was a college student that was 23. And that's when they first met, and their relationship started then. They are very adamant to mention numerous times that her father and brother were also at the camp. So it's not like she was isolated from family, and but also that her father and mother loved Matt and encouraged them dating. And I think the language used was everything was above board, and there was never any kind of, you know, Matt never did anything inappropriate, and everything was done with integrity. But the fact that they even talk about it that way, with all these different qualifying statements, mm-hmm. Means that they recognize on some level that people are going to be concerned that a 17-year-old and a 23-year-old is a little, you know.
Especially when he was preaching, and so in a position of spiritual authority.
And from her own words, she was quite taken with him, mm-hmm. with his ability to preach, that he was a powerful preacher, and you know, that she was attracted to his passion for preaching and for God, and you know, then she of course mentions that he is also, he was handsome then as well, and but still, it's, you know, the age gap where you have a high school student and a college student is concerning for a lot of people. But once you put in on top of that power dynamic of that he is you know, a spiritual, I don't know that I would use authority, but he's a powerful spiritual influence on her, mm-hmm. at this camp at that time. And she talks about him in that way, that he was very influential, mm-hmm. her spiritually.
And I would say leader, because if you're preaching, yes, that's a leadership role. So spiritual leader is, I mean, I would look at it that way.
Yes, spiritual leader, I would like. That seems fair, considering they're, you know. But it's definitely problematic. And in one of the podcasts that she did, the host had even asked her, like, can you explain a little bit about how you met your husband, and, you know, and, you know, what happened then and how you guys start dating, whatever. And she kind of explains the story. And, you know, they make a few jokes here and there. But at some point, one of the hosts says to her, and I'm not sure what year this podcast was, but he says to her, you have a 14-year-old daughter now, right? And she laughs and says, yeah. And he's like, well, now just add 3 years. And she goes, I see what you're asking. And so they, you know, the hosts were like, well, how would you feel about that if your 17-year-old daughter was, you know, involved in someone who's 23? And her answer was interesting, because she says, you know, we think about that a lot, meaning her and Matt, and they've talked about that. And ultimately, she says, if it was someone like Matt, with his character, his passion for God, then it would be okay. But the fact that they think about that a lot indicates that they're both very aware.
Yeah. And there's a level of uncomfortability about it.
Yeah, that this is very problematic. Yeah. And then one of the other quotes that I thought was interesting from her in the podcast transcript, which actually, let me just see here for a second, because I would like to quote it. Hold on. So basically, one of the hosts asks her, and we could also link to this.
Yeah, we'll link to this. Too. Yeah.
Hold on. So one of the hosts says, did Matt wrestle at all with the fact that he was 23 years and he was looking across the fire at a 17-year-old girl, you know, thinking, you know, that he knew that she was going to be his wife, right? And Matt's wife, Lauren, responds, you know, not at those moments. He knew it would be complicated, but I mean, this is Matt Chandler. He's like, give him a hard situation and he's going to conquer it. And that's the language that she's using to describe him as a 23-year-old, you know, making the decisions to begin to date her, that, you know, this is going to be complicated. And he knows that. But he's going to do it anyway, because he's Matt Chandler,
and you know, he conquers. Like, that is such, like, militaristic language.
Yeah.
For romance teen. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. So they're definitely aware, either because they already knew that this was problematic, or because so many people approached them when they were dating or after they were dating and saying, you know, this is so problematic that it is without a doubt already just unethical and possibly abusive, depending on the dynamic that they had, whether or not there was grooming, and whether or not, you know, regardless of whether or not 17 was the age of consent in whatever state she was in, you know, but the unethicalness with him being a leader at her camp, her summer camp,
right,
and the potential for this to have been abusive in some way, you know, it's super problematic. And it, like you said, it plays into the patterns of him not being able to respond correctly in certain other situations that were also very problematic. Mm-hmm. And that, to be fair, when you look back, he kind of conquered those situations too. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think that this is an important conversation, not because we have all the answers. A lot of times we come and we do these hot takes on cultural moments, and we're able to like break down every little thing and be like, well, this is off because of this, that, and the other. And this situation is just odd. But yes, I think this is, a fruitful conversation, because I think a lot of people are grappling with, there's more to the story here that we're not being told. And we're being told a story, which means there's some sort of reaction that they want from us. Mm-hmm. And so what is that reaction supposed to be when you don't have the full information? So that's why I wanted us to go back, and I just want to do like a quick recap. So the kind of the early stories that we've talked about with Matt of questionable, problematic things is him being a 23-year-old adult man preaching, having a spiritual leadership role on a teen summer camp, hitting on a 17-year-old teen, then marrying that teen, doing so many marriage counseling stuff through the years, talking a lot about would they be okay with their daughter doing it at that age. And so there's obviously some sort of hang up inside of them that something feels not quite right with that. Then for being the great marriage counselor he is, and I'm being very sarcastic, completely butchers the situation with Karen Hinckley and how he's supposed to respond to a woman who's been deeply hurt by her husband, who's doing such gross things, is watching these abuse images online of children, completely messing that up. Then we don't have proof of this, but there's allegations, and I tend to side with the 11-year-old child, that there was some mishandling and maybe some of the low bar stuff reporting to the police happened, which, good job, not a lot of churches do that, but it seems like there was a lot to be desired within that sexual relationship. And when I say relationship, I don't mean that that was consensual, but that sexual situation, that sexual abuse situation, a lot to be desired there. And then we come to today. And today we have a vague story of him supposedly getting too friendly with another woman who's not his wife. People are saying that it's not romantic or sexual, but it was coarse and foolish joking. But it was bad enough for an independent investigation to happen and for him to be put on leave. So with all that information, I kind of want to leave it up to the audience to be like, what are your thoughts on this? Because it seems like there's a lot more there, but until they release a report, hopefully with redacted information so it's private and not putting the other woman in the woman, I'm not trying to use his euphemisms, but putting that woman in a worse spot than she's likely already in. You know, why would they do that? Why would they do that? And it seems like everything they do is pretty calculated. And like you said, that Matt tries to conquer everything in the words of his wife. So what's he working on conquering with this PR spin?
Well, from his own words, he'd be working on conquering his unhealth.
So a bit unresolved. How are you feeling? Same.
A bit unresolved. The one thing that I also would add, kind of to the pattern, is he doesn't believe he's done anything wrong, but the elders do, right? But nothing egregious, apparently. But then he's doing this, the platform apology, which we've seen over and over and over again. And it's usually by people who have done terrible things and are minimizing those terrible things, like Andy Savage and Bill Hybels and, John Crist. And so we've seen this pattern play out before. And the pattern of the apology, the public apology that Matt does, fits the pattern of these other guys. But there's no real admission of anything having been done that's, it's too vague. But the fact that he's doing the public apology, what is that? Like, that indicates that there's, just like in the other cases, that there may be more. And that this is, a controlling the information and a controlling the narrative kind of situation. And also it's, as I've talked about before, and you too, Ashley, that, making public apologies from a platform like that, is often used as a form of community grooming. Set people up to defend somebody who has done something, you know, criminal or terrible or unethical. So it's, you know, and with Matt Chandler, we don't know. We just don't know. Because, you know, what if he just has a friend? And if that's the case, like you said, Ashley, we have issues with friendship in the evangelical community anyway. But yeah, so the fact that the apology happened at all also is part of the pattern to me. You know,
agreed.
Like, and the way it's happening. So
agreed. Yeah, well, I think this is one where we're gonna just kind of punt to the listeners to give us their thoughts on this, because we're not settled. We don't know. These things usually have a way of unraveling, kind of like an onion. So we might be back here in a couple months giving you an update. But yeah, let us know what you think. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Maureen, for co-hosting with me today. As always, you just have a brilliant mind. And and then everybody, I just want to encourage you, if you're not following us on our social media, we have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You can find us there. All of our back episodes are on our website, courage365.org. We have a variety of free resources, including this book, Five Keys to Living a Life of Courage. We also have a text message list. This is something I'm most proud of. These are empowering messages written by survivors for survivors. We send them out Monday through Friday. They're free, and all you have to do to sign up for them is send a text message to this number. Get your pen and paper out, grab your phone, open to a clean text message. Got it? Ready? Okay. The number is 917-809-7311. That is 917-809-7311. And in the message part, just put the word courage. When you do that, hit send, you'll automatically be added to our text message list. Well, everybody, we would love to hear what your thoughts are on this situation. And if you have any insights additional to what we said, if anything resonates with you, like we said, this is a good conversation. I think you might want to share with your friends and family to kind of highlight some of these patterns. But thank you so much for watching, and live with courage.